So a long time ago, in an orogeny far, far away, mountains slowly emerged from the depths of the earth, not only creating the Rockies, but also raising the Edwards Plateau, including the land we are on top of here today in San Marcos. As mountains buildeth, erosion taketh away. Water, through the action of freezing and thawing, and through the action of brooks babbling into streams and streams streaming into rivers, carried pieces of the Rockies clear across the proto-Texas and deposited these pieces just to the east of here, laying the sands of the Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer. There are two things to note here. One, the beach used to be a lot closer to San Marcos than it is today. And two, if your significant other wants to visit the Rocky Mountains and you don't want to, you can drive about 30 miles east of here, point to the ground, and say, "Here you go, the Rocky Mountains." Over time, these beach sands were buried and naturally cemented. After the seas receded, rainwater eventually flushed out the seawater, creating what we know today as the Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer. Since then, Europeans discovered Texas, Texians fought for independence, the Beatles conquered America, Dallas spawned Vanilla Ice, and to bring us completely current, Super Bowl 50 gave us Puppy Monkey Baby. Ugh. So here we are as Texans today. Our state is growing rapidly. San Antonio and Austin are expected to double in population over the next 50 years. Comal County is expected to nearly triple in population over the next 50 years. In Hays County, it will be four times larger than it is today in 50 years. That's a lot of bobcats. So the I-35 growth corridor needs water. Where will that water come from? Depending on your perspective, the location of the Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer, nestled as it is with the I-35 growth corridor, is ideally located as a water resource to meet growing needs. However, others are concerned about water level declines, spring flows, and the sustainability of the resource. So tonight we're here to discuss the characteristics of the aquifer and the ability of the aquifer to sustainably serve long-term needs of the region. Joining me is an excellent panel of hydrogeologists that all have firsthand experience of working and issues associated with the aquifer. And so allow me to quickly introduce our panel. On my far left, your far right, is Dr. Bill Hutchison, who is also a registered engineer as well as a registered geoscientist. We have James Binet next to him. Oh, and I should note that Bill has his own consulting firm. He's a consulting hydrogeologist. We've got James Binet, who's a registered professional geoscientist. He's a principal at R.W. Hardin & Associates. On my far right, your far left, is George Rice, a professional geoscientist, also a practicing hydrogeologist. And to my immediate right is Steve Young, who has a Ph.D., also a registered engineer and a registered geoscientist, and is a principal at Intera Geosciences. All these folks are also groundwater modelers and have worked with the models, and I'm a recovering groundwater modeler, so if you see me twitch uncontrollably, that's why. It's been a while since I've touched a model, but of course I still love them. So without further ado, kind of the way tonight's going to go is up until 8 o'clock, I've got some questions that I'm going to ask these folks to get the discussion going. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to go ahead and open up to the audience for questions. And there's a microphone back right in front of me that you can approach if you have a question when we approach that 8 o'clock hour. And we'll try to get through as quickly as possible. Also, just a few ground rules. Please be respectful of the discussion. You may hear things you really like and want to hoot and holler. You may hear things you don't like and you want to hoot and holler. We're just asking the chill, you know, take it all in. Observe the pros and the cons of the discussion tonight. So, without further ado, probably ought to pick someone to pick on. Let's pick on Steve first. Is groundwater use expected to increase across the Carrizo-Wilcox?
Well, thanks for the easy one. The short answer is yes. I need to go into some more detail than that.
It's up to you.
Yes, the population is if you take the central part of the Cruiser Wilcox, is going to double. It's probably going about 1 to 2 million in the lower part. The south part will probably triple. If you look at the DFC runs that the GMAs are running in 12, you know the rates are going from about 200,000, I think, to about 300,000, I think 400,000. And in the, it's 200,000 acre feet to 500,000 acre feet, and the southern is going about 300,000 acre feet to 550,000. So it's clearly it's going to increase, and it's going to be centered at the question is really is where it's going to be pumped the most, because it's not going to be uniform, and that's really what the, I think the discussion is going to lead to today.
Any other panelists want to throw in on that?
Yes, I would.
Go ahead, George, first.
I've been working mostly in four counties east of Austin. Bastrop and Lee, they're part of the, or they are the Lost Pines Groundwater Conservation District. And Burleson and Milam County, that's the Post Oak Savannah Groundwater Conservation District. And in these four counties alone, groundwater use is projected to increase from around 25,000 acre feet a year in the year 2000 to around 200,000 acre feet a year by 2060. And most of that increase will occur in the next 5-10 years as some large water export projects come online.
Bill?
Yeah, you'll notice on the map behind us, the Cariza Wilcox extends from Louisiana all the way down to Mexico. And the Water Development Board has essentially split it up into three parts, three groundwater management areas, 11, 12, and 13. 11 is the northern one. I work in 11 and 13. 11, historic pumping has been a little over 100,000 acre feet, and the scenarios that we're running now, you know, would bring that up to just shy of 400,000. In GMA 13, which is the southern part, we're going from somewhere around 300,000 to about almost 600,000. Is what we're projecting.
Disagree with that, James?
I don't disagree with that. I'm very certain that the demand for Cariza Wilcox aquifer water will increase through time. I think that's a given.
Okay, well, that's kind of the easy one, just to kind of get things greased up a little bit, get you all comfortable. But here's a more difficult one, and we'll go ahead and give it to James first. Can the aquifer produce at that rate that is expected for the future?
Well, that's a complex question, obviously. There are a lot of different components to that. Obviously, you know, what we need to look at as far as a community or a society goes, I think can be boiled down into a couple of somewhat broad topics, in that I think what most of us are worried about with pumping the Cariza Wilcox or any other aquifer is, number one, are we depleting the resource at a rate that is unacceptable to us? Are we being greedy? Are we overpumping? Are we not leaving enough for future generations? That's a primary concern, I think, to everybody involved. The second concern would be, are we expected or are we going to cause unacceptable environmental impacts from pumping this water? Some people maybe would also state that maybe there's some economic concerns. I personally think that gets wrapped back into the depletion of the resource. It's by nature, as you deplete the resource, it becomes more expensive to produce it. So can the Cariza Wilcox produce the water for the foreseeable future? I think that it can, and it's really a function of the storage capacity of the aquifer. It was surprising to me, and I mentioned this just a minute ago, when this group of people were starting to produce the groundwater models, or starting to construct them, I, as a hydrogeologist, had sort of a patchwork understanding of how this all worked. When we worked for a particular entity or a municipality, we were always focused on one county or another. When we were able to assemble these regional groundwater models, it really started to click how these really large geologic formations and aquifer systems work throughout the state. And it was surprising to me, too, when we started to be able to query these models for what we call the model water budget. In other words, how much water is in the aquifer, how much is recharged, discharged. And we come to find out that there are actually hundreds of millions of acre-feet stored in the Carrizo-Wilcox in central and southern Texas. And to put that into perspective, all of the lakes in Texas, when they're full, hold about 30 million acre-feet. So the two primary formations of the Carrizo-Wilcox are the Simsboro and the Carrizo, and they hold 10 times as much water as all of Texas lakes. And so can this resource be used to supply that demand? 500,000 acre-feet per year, 600,000 acre-feet per year is an awful lot of water. But putting that into perspective of the literal hundreds of millions of acre-feet stored in the aquifer maybe lends a different slant to it.
Let me go ahead and get George's perspective on that.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's certainly true that the Carrizo-Wilcox contains a huge amount of water. James said several hundred million acre-feet, and those are the numbers I've heard. But the same thing is true of the Edwards Aquifer. Certainly they're different. The Edwards is a karst system, and Carrizo-Wilcox is more sand and gravel. But the Edwards also contains a huge amount of water. But we limit the amount of water that we pump from the Edwards because we know that if we take too much from it, it could harm people and could harm endangered species. And I think the same is true of the Carrizo-Wilcox. We could pump huge amounts of water from the Carrizo-Wilcox for a long time if we weren't concerned about the possible harm that doing so would cause. And so although there's a lot of water there, I think we need to also consider what the effects of pumping too much water from the aquifer will be.
George is right, but I'll help you put things in perspective a little bit. When you're looking at these big volumes of water, like 500,000 acre-feet, if you look over the central Gamma area, that's actually less than about a half an inch, on the average, and same thing with the 550,000 acre-feet for the southern part. The area that is the most susceptible to all these impacts is the outcrop, and that's the shallow area. That's where most of the domestic wells are put. That's the updip portion, the northern portion of these aquifers, where they start, they're always dipping. They're on a slight angle. And in the slight angle area is called the confined section. It's down thousands of feet. And the idea is to try to get the larger pumpers to get far enough down into these aquifers, down thousands of feet where there's fresh water. In fact, there's fresh water down to about 4,000 feet in Post Oak. I work up in Burleson County, and I think you almost can go down to 5,000 feet in some places in Frio County. So the idea is really where the pumping is going to happen. And when you start putting pumping up dip where the domestic wells are, where your rivers are, this is where the discussion is going to end up going is what can that actually sustain? Because I think most of us, when you do the math, you do the numbers, you can pull very large volumes out of the deeper part, and these cones of influence, literally where the water comes from is literally hundreds of miles away. In 20 years, these cones spread out in the deep part, whereas when it's the shallow part, they stay more concentrated where they pull the water. And I think it takes good management to take care of that in an eye to the aquifer to make sure you're monitoring to see what's going on. These things don't happen overnight; they take decades for it to happen. James will talk a little bit about Alcoa. They've pumped 30,000 acre feet up there in the outcrop. In Milam County, kind of stabilized. They had some impacts. They were easily mitigated, and also up there at College Bryan Station, they've been pumping about the same amount, 30,000 acre feet for 10 years. And that cone is deeper part. It's down there. Not too many wells are impacted, and it's continuing to grow. And we're monitoring that. So, absolutely, if you pump in the right place, you're not going to have a problem. Pump the wrong place. There's some issues that we have to take care of.
Bill, do you want to add anything?
Yeah. I think Steve hit on something. Location matters. And one of the things that the science of hydrogeology has taught us is that the amount of recharge doesn't matter and the amount of storage doesn't matter. When you pump a well, you're interested in what is the capture. That well is capturing water. Some of it's storage, some of it's river base flow, some of it's spring flow, some of it is pulling in water from far, far away. And so depending on where the wells are located, that's going to have a big difference on it, what the capture dynamics are like. So we often hear things about how many gajillion gallons or acre feet there are of storage, and really it doesn't matter. Because what we're interested in is the capture, and what we're interested in is trying to define the impacts of that pumping. You started the question off pretty simply. Can that water be pumped? Yeah. But I think we've also heard, what are the impacts? And that's what the models are helpful to help define what those impacts are. And it's not about the storage, it's not about the recharge, it's about the capture. And these are things that often don't get explained very well, because we're kind of in the world of sound bites with how much storage is there. 15 years ago, it was how much is the recharge. And so that's been a lot of the work that we've been trying to do, is help define the impacts, not only in terms of drawdown, because those are dramatic maps, but also in terms of the water budget impacts, how many spring flows are going to be affected, how much river flow is going to be affected, and how much storage is going to be affected.
Anybody want to comment? We'll go to the next question.
I would love to comment.
Please do.
Okay. We're having sort of similar agreements here. There's a journal out there called Groundwater. It's what the professional folks like myself read quite often. And there was an editorial back in 97 talking about this capture. This capture is a very difficult thing to understand. It's really not recharge. People like to look at the recharge value and say that's the limiting factor. And I'll read it's from a 1997 John Bredehoff, who's a USGS researcher, and he talks about capture. This is a quote I brought. He says, sustainable groundwater developments have almost nothing to do with recharge. Capture from natural discharge is usually what determines the size of a sustainable development. That's probably pretty shocking news to a lot of folks. That's not always the case, because he's talking generalities. Something like the Ogallala would be an exception. It's a little different than what we're talking about here. But it goes to what I think all of us hopefully will kind of agree with, is initially you're pumping water around a well, but as the cone spreads out, it has to find water to make that sustainable. It may go to rivers. It may look at other aquifers as the water's going vertically up and down. It could go from a few other sources, but it's that capture that really determines it, and it's not just a recharge. I gave a little discussion out there on the TAG Summit in 2013 to kind of show that, and did something on the Gulf Coast just to show that the sustainable flow there, meaning it would be the pumping rate would level off about 9 times the recharge rate. So it's always some multiple the recharge rate in an aquifer like the Carrizo Wilcox.
Sure, I could just add the capture is important. This is, you know, this goes back to C.V. Tice and basically our basic equations and understanding of how aquifer systems work. You can kind of think of it, rule of thumb is, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. If you're gonna pump a well, you're gonna create a space, or basically you're going to take water out of an area. It's going to try and replace that water any way that it can. It's going to try and grab it from overlying formations. It may come from the side. That's an important property of aquifers. And when we're talking about absolute sustainability, in other words, no change in storage over time, that's very important. When we're talking about regional planning and trying to use this as a resource, as a society, we have very different metrics for what is acceptable depletion of a source. For example, in the Panhandle with the Ogallala, they're managing it for depletion rate of 50% of that saturated thickness in 50 years. So that's a pretty aggressive depletion rate. Here, when we look at the models, we're looking at a 2 to 3% depletion rate over the next 50 years. It's a very different depletion rate. Storage does matter in the same way that if I was to tell you or ask you whether or not you tell you that you had an income every month of $1,000 and asked you whether or not you could afford a $2,000 a month car payment, right off the bat, everybody says, well, no, I can't. But if I give you extra information and if I tell you you have $10 million in the bank, well, that may change your attitude toward that. And I think that's really, as a society, where we have to go. We know we're going to need this water, and we have I hate to use the term, but it's a vast resource. And we're planning on using it responsibly. And, again, it does matter where you pump. We need to be careful about the depletion rate. We also need to be careful about environmental impacts. And so the distribution of pumpage is important. And, in fact, there's a difference in the impacts depending on where you are. When you're near an outcrop, you're going to impact surface-groundwater interaction. When you're farther down dip, you have much less of that. Your impacts are spread out through a much more regional area.
Now, Steve pointed out that Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer is a confined aquifer. And it's very different than the Ogallala, which is a water table aquifer.
Right.
In a confined aquifer, it's under pressure. If you've heard the term artesian pressure or artesian wells, many of the wells and the most productive zones of the aquifer are in that artesian zone. And my question is it realistic to expect that we can go and start actually draining the Carrizo-Wilcox? Is that even economically feasible? Because in my sense, a lot of the value of these artesian aquifers is the artesian driving force, the hydraulic head towards the wells. I'll ask them. Ask James first. It kind of relates directly to what he's saying.
Sure. It's no doubt. There are huge differences between these types of aquifers. The Edwards Aquifer behaves very differently than the Carrizo-Wilcox, which behaves very differently from the Ogallala. In the Ogallala, they're managing to, 50% decline in 50 years because they're so linked to the agriculture that they can't not do it. Every time you pump a well, any groundwater user removes water from storage in one way or another. So you're always depleting storage. It may be a local depletion of storage, but I think really what we're talking about here is what are we as a society willing to sustain on a regional basis? We're looking at this in large scale. Can we support the development that we can see coming in the I-35 corridor? Where is that water going to come from? Our best models at this point, with no recharge involved, we've performed these simulations, show a 50-year storage depletion of 3 or 4% at most. And so, it's always a value call. It's a judgment call. Is that too much? Is that too little? All we can do as hydrogeologists is tell you what it's likely to be. But there is no obvious environmental or other impacts involved in that. There will be some depletion of stream flow. Is that important versus the overall supply of water? Sure. Do these things need to be balanced? Yes.
Bill?
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear. We're going back to the storage business, and James quotes this number of 2 or 3%. And that's assuming that the models are somehow accurately able to calculate storage. Well, quite frankly, the models were not developed to do that. They've been sort of bootstrapped to do this, and there's a big conceptual flaw that gets into some technical terms. But basically what happens is this confined portion of the Carrizo is assumed to be this kind of this bathtub of sand. And those are the parameters that are put in there in the model, but it's basically just placeholders because no one's ever pumped down that far to find out if those parameters are correct. So when you hear this 2 or 3%, the notion is, well, that's so little, how could it possibly cause a problem? Well, what if those numbers are off by a factor of 10? What if they're off by a factor of 100? And the 3% turns into 30%. Well, these are things that we just don't know at this point. Basically, again, it goes back to the idea that I mentioned earlier. The total storage really isn't the issue. The issue is the capture. Now, when we've run the simulations with the models for GMA 13, the southern part of the Carrizo-Wilcox, that increase in pumping that I had talked about, where we go from 300,000 to 600,000, that big bump, only 44% of that captured water is coming from storage. About 20% of it is coming from capture of stream flow, base flow from rivers. About 28% is being pulled in from adjoining groundwater management areas, about half of it from GMA 12 and half of it from GMA 15. So we're basically interested in, again, going back to the idea of capture, that's the more important understanding of what the impacts are, not saying, oh, it's only 2 or 3% of storage, because that number may not be correct. We have a much better handle on what the capture is based on the model construction rather than using it as a raw data set to calculate total storage. George?
Yeah, I'd like to draw a distinction between the artesian zone and the unconfined zone, or the recharge zone. When you pump from the artesian zone, that's the zone that's buried under land surface, in some cases thousands of feet below land surface. You're dropping the artesian head in the aquifer so that water levels in wells will decline, but you're not actually draining the aquifer. The aquifer itself remains full. Contrast that to the recharge zones where the aquifers are exposed at land surface. They're not confined, and as the cones of depression from pumping the artesian zones move into the unconfined zones, their declines in water level actually begins removing water from the aquifer, draining portions of the aquifer. And I think when it comes to wells, people that have wells in the deeper artesian zone are vulnerable to some extent to the effects of pumping. But the people that are most vulnerable are the people who live in these shallow, unconfined zones where water levels in the aquifer will actually decline, and there are plenty of very shallow wells there that may either actually go dry or the water level in them will be so low that they will become useless. So I think it's important to think of these, to draw the distinction between what happens in the artesian portion of the aquifer and what happens in the recharge zone or unconfined portions of the aquifer. And I'd just like to add one comment about, do we need this water from the Carrizo? I really don't know much about need other than San Antonio. And then, San Antonio is going to be one of the biggest draws on the Carrizo-Wilcox with the Vista Ridge project. And in my opinion, San Antonio does not need the water from the Carrizo.
Steve, you got any storage comments or draining the aquifer comments?
I will return to the original question about whether it's economically or feasible to do that. And the short answer is no. I don't know if you have a perspective for just how deep this portion of the aquifer goes, but it is thousands of feet in this artesian zone that they're talking about. In this unconfined zone, you're probably going maybe 800 feet deep. And the ability to just put enough wells in and that deep and that technology, it's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper to desal and pipe it all throughout Texas. I mean, that's from the ocean, basically. So it's not going to happen, and economically, it's just not viable. But again, we're looking at that shallow zone. Maybe for that's less than 1,000 feet. That's where the emphasis should be on the discussion.
I like to note that all the pumping scenarios I've seen in terms of folks using the aquifer, that is a pressure depletion. I don't think I've seen any runs or any projects proposed that actually pull the water level down where it's actually physically draining the aquifer.
That's correct.
But as a hydrogeologist, I wonder, that once you bleed off that
artesian pressure, you know, do you have to start infill drilling wells, and does that get real expensive? Steve made a comment about cones of depression or drawdown when you're pumping a well and it reaching out, and perhaps it's pulling in water many times, recharge. My experience with artesian aquifers in Texas is that you wind up getting the you wind up maintaining water levels in the outcrop or in the unconfined or the recharge zone. One example is in the Trinity Aquifer in Dallas-Fort Worth, and it's harder for the water to get through that aquifer than the Carrizo, but it is a sandstone, and they have over 1,000 feet of water level declines. It's all artesian pressure that they've bled off. They've actually increased the flow going deeper into the aquifer, yet there's very little to no perceptible change in water levels in the recharge zone or even losses to rivers and streams. Similar thing we see down in the Gulf Coast aquifer in the Houston area, where they've had 400 feet of water level declines. Interesting thing about the Trinity Aquifer in Dallas-Fort Worth is, you know, if you believe the model, the amount of recharge is actually going deeper into the aquifer from the recharge zone is less than probably 1%. I bet that's probably higher for the Carrizo Wilcox, but I want to put that out there. You know, what do you think the pumping impacts are on the outcrop? We've heard a little bit of that. Are they going to be substantial or not? Start with George.
Yeah. Looking at what we can see at present with present rates of pumping. You know, it's true that when you look at shallow wells in, say, the Simsboro, in most cases they're pretty stable, fluctuate from year to year, but no overall drawdown. Except in some cases, you do see some substantial drawdown. You see a drawdown of 20, 30 feet in some wells at this rate of pumping. So that makes you wonder if we're getting drawdown in some of these wells presently, what's going to happen when we increase pumping in that area by a factor of 8 or so over the next 20 years, 10, 20 years. And looking at the results of the GAM, the GAM does predict that there will be declines in water levels in the unconfined zones as a result of the pumping.
And if you don't know what a GAM is, it's a groundwater availability model, so it's a computer model that simulates the aquifer. I might point out that the GAM might not be doing a very good job of simulating the phenomena I just described in terms of a lot of recharge coming in, coming out as rejected recharge, and then the effect of recharge going deeper into the aquifer.
Well, I think we'll discuss the GAM.
Bill, anything to say about that?
Yeah, like I said before, the simulations that we've run in GMA 13 suggest that 20% of that increased pumping is going to come from induced stream flow. So the model may not be the best tool that could be made, but it's the best tool that we have. And it certainly is sobering to look at that and certainly suggest that additional work needs to be done and I know that model is hopefully going to be updated here in the next 5 to 10 years, and some additional mapping work's being done right now. And certainly that's the improving the groundwater surface water interactions of these models needs to be a priority.
James, how much impact on the outcrop do you think large amounts of pumping will have?
Sure, and you know, this is something that we don't need models to tell us. We've been pumping the Carrizo Wilcox for decades, and we've been keeping fairly good water level records for wells throughout the region. You know, on the order of 300,000 acre feet per year, maybe more, maybe less, in South Texas. And we went back and looked to see whether or not we could find long-term water level records for wells in the outcrop. You know, if we've produced 300 plus feet of artesian pressure decline in these down-dip areas in South Texas, surely we must see something happening in the outcrop. And the surprising thing, and again, this is all data that you can get online, it's freely available from the Water Development Board, shows that not only has there not been a decline in saturated thickness, in other words, the these shallow water table wells have not declined in water levels, in saturated thickness. The other surprising thing was that the water levels in those wells remained rock steady through all of our most major drought periods, through the 50s, even the 60s, we had one in the 80s. And it was surprising as a hydrogeologist to be able to see these large declines and see that really there hasn't been that much of an impact in these outcrop water levels. Once we saw that in South Texas, we began to look around a little bit more. We see exactly the same effect in the Simsboro Aquifer in Central Texas. We looked at the Trinity. We were responsible as a firm for putting together, or part of the team to put together the Trinity GAM, and that's really kind of where that came from. As we saw these 1,000-foot declines, and they look horrible on a map, and so we said, well, you know, what has that done to the overall water and storage? And I've got to go back, because I have to address what Bill said. We go back and forth like this all the time.
This is what we want.
Right. The model was always intended to calculate storage. It is a mass input-output balance that makes that model work. The layers that we have in those models were derived from structure, as you know, from field measurements, geophysical logs. We have a pretty good understanding of how thick it is. We know what it's made of. And we know in the laboratory that the porosity of these sandstones varies between, maybe 18 and 22 or 23%. We can't be that wrong with these models as far as the storage calculation. That being said, the Southern Texas model, the one that you're quoting as the overwhelming evidence for a large amount of stream depletion, does an absolutely horrible job of mimicking those water levels that we've seen historically. When you compare those cell-by-cell values in the model with historical water level measurements, you'll see 200 or 300-foot declines in the outcrop where the actual measurement shows zero. So there we have it.
Yeah, Bill, those are two separate issues. One is, I agree the model is not as good as it really needs to be, and it does need to be improved. The first part of it, though, where the model was intended to be a storage model is not exactly true. Basically, you've got this eight-layer structure, each layer being an aquifer or an aquitard, a high permeability zone or a low permeability zone, and you assign parameters to them. And the key things we're talking about here, when it's a confined aquifer, you put in what's known as specific storage. And when it's an unconfined aquifer, you put in what's known as specific yield. Now, the specific yield is in this unconfined, like the Ogallala, where it's very high. And so the idea is that basically if you're drawing the water levels down to the point where it's just a pressure response, you're in the specific storage. No problem there. Models are calibrated based on that parameter because that's within the range of what we've historically observed, where the water levels are still under an artesian pressure. Now we're getting down to this lower part where we had talked earlier about the economics of actually draining that confined portion. Well, once that water level, theoretically, once that water level gets below the top of it, now you're in an unconfined system. But when you look at the logs of the wells over that thickness of the layer, it's not a big homogeneous sand, even though that's what's the parameter that's put in the model. And that is largely, like I said, a placeholder. You got to put some number in there, but the model certainly isn't calibrated to that parameter. And all I'm saying is that if you use the model blindly, you'll get these big storage numbers without, and no one has ever questioned, are these numbers appropriate in a situation where we've never observed water levels getting down that far. We're talking thousands of feet. And that's a very important part of this storage discussion, that these numbers are based on something that no one's even thought of.
So let me ask this question. Is the current amount of pumping in the aquifer sustainable? And allow me to define sustainable. The way I define it is the definition the U.S. Geological Survey defines it, which is able to pump the certain amount of groundwater volume indefinitely with acceptable impacts. Let's set aside whether or not the impacts are acceptable or not and just talk about, is it possible to pump what is being pumped today indefinitely into the future? And I'm going to ask Steve first.
I appreciate that, Robert. I'm going to change the question a little bit and come around to that question. The let's use a number of maybe 500,000 acre feet to be pumped out of the central and southern part of the Carrizo Wilcox. That in itself, over the course of 100 years or so, I would say would be sustainable if you were to be pumping it in the right locations. And if you had the proper management in place and you're doing a little bit of aquifer recharge. The question comes down, though, is it sustainable where we're currently pumping or where it's planned? And that comes down to the question of how you're going to manage. And I think when you start discussing pumping, you have to start talking about management rules and how people are going to enforce those. That's really what it comes down to make people feel comfortable. If there is some evidence that there's going to be some harm happening, there is something to protect the landowners. And I think that topic is kind of goes hand in hand with sustainability. And you know, I've worked with some GCDs, and I think when you start looking at how you're going to handle this issue, it's important to be able to have some type of correlative right, so that you can, as issues as correlative right means you're tying the amount someone can pump in an area to the land they own. So as if you start seeing impacts are starting to happen, you can actually uniformly achieve one fairly and start throttling back that pro rata amount of correlative right. It's important to be able to have some type of short-term mitigation plans in place with large-scale pumping. You typically, the mitigation area it doesn't tend to be that large. It may be a couple miles outside, and I work with the GCD that makes sure that kind of that happens with the big pumpers. You're looking at, you know, proper well spacing. You're looking at making sure that the permittees, when they come in and agree to pump, they agree to abide by the rules, and if the rules change, they're willing to abide by those. So those type of issues, I think, are real important when you're looking at sustainability, is looking at not only the technical part, but also the policy part, and that falls on the GCDs being able to help protect the conservation part and the existing users, but as well as to balance the future use and the need for economic and social development in the area.
So it sounds like your answer is, I don't know.
No, I think it has to be tied. I said it. If you were to manage it properly with the right rules, it absolutely is sustainable.
Okay. Yes. Bill, want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think sustainable goes back to this concept of capture, because basically what you're talking about is that the water levels remain stable, and water levels remain stable when your inflows and your outflows are balanced. So if you have increased your pumping, you've lowered the water levels initially and started to capture water in from streams or from adjacent areas, and then water levels are flat again, essentially in a new state of equilibrium. That defines what is sustainable. So if water levels, our data show that water levels are flat right now, that means that the 300,000 that's being pumped, at least in South Texas, is sustainable. The question then becomes, what happens if you bump it up again? Well, if the water levels then reach a new lower level but then are flat, that's sustainable. If they continue to drop, that would then be not sustainable, at least under this, you know, kind of narrow definition. And based on our runs with the imperfect models, it suggests that at least within a 50-year time frame, water levels are going to continue to drop and not start to flatten out. That may be a modeling problem. That may be another problem, and that's where, as Steve mentioned, managing, monitoring, those sorts of things, updating the models becomes important. The models at this point, they're only as good as the data that we have and the concepts that we've put in. The fact that we have to update desired future conditions every 5 years highlights the importance of keeping the tools current and keeping them updated with the latest data. So at this point, the answer is current pumping, yeah, it's fine. Future increases, the current models suggest caution and need for additional work and thinking about that as far as what these impacts might be.
James?
Sure, I agree. The data speak for themselves. The lack of water table decline in the outcrops speaks volumes. It's also important to note that changes in these water levels, in these outcrop water levels, will be very slow and steady through time. In general, you're going to see trends. Let me back up a little bit. When you turn on a well in a down dip zone, it's bleeding artesian pressure, and you can create a large, what's known as cone of depression in that artesian pressure system that will expand out throughout many counties, and it can be several hundred feet thick. That will, those decreases in pressure expand out. Eventually, they do impact and interact with outcrop water levels. At that point, you're not bleeding pressure out of the aquifer anymore. In order to create drawdown, you have to physically drain pore spaces in between the sand grains that make up the aquifer. That's why the amount of drawdown that we see in artesian zones doesn't correlate very well, or doesn't seem to correlate very well, with what we've observed in the outcrop. So while I think it's very, we're all doing the right thing. We need to look at this. We all need to monitor and be concerned. But I can tell you that the physics of the aquifer will let you know on a scale of decades whether or not you're having more of an impact than you think you're going to. This is not something that can happen overnight. It just simply isn't physically possible.
George?
Yeah, I think that the current rate is sustainable in the sense that, it can be pumped for a long time at this rate. But I think I have to agree with Steve in that it's important how we manage it, and we can't separate this issue of, when you talk about sustainability, you do have to talk about adverse effects. And that's where the role of the groundwater conservation districts is very important. I've seen two approaches in the areas I've worked at. One is with Post Oak District, where they we'll take Vista Ridge and say you can pump 50,000 acre feet a year and from day one. If you contrast that with Lost Pines, where in dealing with Four Star, what they said, let's do a stepped approach. They're talking about pumping 28,500 acre feet per year eventually, but they say first pump 12,000 acre feet a year and we'll monitor and we'll see what the effects are. Then if the effects are acceptable, then you can step up to 20,000. And then if they're acceptable, you can step up to 28,500. If they're not acceptable, you can't go up. I think that's the wise approach to managing the resource. Do it cautiously in a stepwise fashion, and then if the effects are unacceptable, then you haven't already gone beyond what the aquifer can sustain without causing unacceptable amounts of harm.
So last week I had the pleasure of listening in on a House Committee on Natural Resources interim hearing last week, and County Judge Bert Cobb got up and addressed the committee, and he said there's three kinds of lies. There's lies, there's dam lies, and there's hydrologist reports. I'm going to spin that in a positive way. That oftentimes there isn't a single answer. There's uncertainty wrapped around all these answers, and you've all heard from each of these folks talk about that. So I think my last question before we open it up to the audience to ask questions is, what are those uncertainties, and how can we make the models or improve the models so we can come up with better answers with less gray area around whatever the real answer is? And I'll start off with Bill.
Thank you. Basically, the GAM program started in the year 1999, 2000, something like that. And all the aquifers in the state have been modeled, pretty much all of them now. And in that time period, when the models were first developed, you know, the expectation revolved around regional planning and groundwater availability. And since then, since that program started, the whole desired future process condition has picked up, and there have been improvements to the codes, and models have been updated and continue to improve. Some of the fundamental things that need specific attention are groundwater surface water interactions, and some of the new codes are better able to handle that. So I think that's one of the things that we definitely need to focus on in terms of our improvement. We also have to realize that a lot of data have been collected since these models have been developed, and so that is an ever the models are data hungry, and the more data we have, the better the models will be. And while the models were being developed, data continued to be collected. Now we need to make sure that all the updated data are in place. One of the biggest problems that we'll continue to have is being able to quantify pumping. Groundwater wells are ubiquitous throughout the state. A lot of them are small wells, and we don't have records on them because they're just domestic wells. A lot of agricultural wells are not metered. So we'll always have a challenge in trying to understand or having good data on what pumping is in various places. So I think groundwater surface water interactions and just updating the models with water level data will be a big step forward in continuing to leverage the improvements in the modeling codes.
Steve, what are your thoughts on uncertainties and improving the models?
I got a lot of thoughts on this one. So we might not get to questions. I do work for one of the groundwater districts, Post Oak, and Vista Ridge came to 2003, 2004. They started running some models. I was involved. I looked at the model runs and thought the model had some issues way back then. And we looked at some one of the issues up there, there's faults in these models. And these faults are soon to be sort of barriers to flow. Over time, some of these sediments shift hundreds, 700-600 feet, and you wonder just how well water can get through them. Well, these faults are in strategic locations by some of these big pumping centers, and they really cause a lot of drawdown with them in the model. If you take them out, literally the max drawdown drops hundreds of feet, 300-400 feet, and we had looked at it when this was going on. We had been looking at geophysical well logs. We had pump tests that were done after the model was developed. It didn't indicate those faults. Some of these key faults were there. And so we knew that that had to be done, that had to be fixed. We're also looking at surface groundwater interaction, which was a big issue there, everywhere. And I was looking at the model results and had just finished up a project that I had been a PM on, the Elsray SAWS project, from 2003 to 2009. We spent $3 million. A lot of it to study surface groundwater interactions. We devised a model, used some of the techniques that Bill had mentioned, and had changed it. And we went from a model that was showing losing streams and water going in streams into the aquifer to something gaining. The model, instead of predicting only 5% of the contribution to the river, was 90%. We knew that had to be fixed. We knew how to fix it. We also knew that a lot of tests done, aquifer tests that were done by Blue Water at that time, by Four Star, from NDOP, all this had to be worked in. So, you know, at that time, that district stepped up and said it needed to be done. They put $200,000 out there. And it took 7 years, but we're working on a new model now. River districts have contributed money. TWD's contributed money for groundwater districts. I'm working on that with TWDB. It's being redone. It's $800,000. That's still it takes a big effort to get these things done. So, you know, this model, when you start hearing people compare model results, every hydrogeologist will use that model a little differently based on what their experiences is. You never hear many people talk too much about the limitations of the model, what the confidence limit is, how sure are we of that, what's the uncertainty. And that's really where, again, the rubber meets the road. When people start talking that, you'll find that when two people are talking two extremes. When you look at their uncertainties and get them to quantify it, sometimes they overlap a little bit. And so that whole aspect of getting the data, getting these models updated, and quantifying a little bit of uncertainty and so that the public can understand that these are not numbers that are to the third decimal point. There is a lot of uncertainty in them. If we can convey that to the public, I think there'll be a lot less controversy about whether this, you know, why two people can say two different things. Because it's just a matter of the confidence we have in that model. Person A may have a lot of confidence, person B may have a lot less, or makes a little bit of a different decision on that. So we're making good inroads, but there's, like as Bill said, there's a lot to be done. We're a long ways away. So when you're managing, you have to manage under uncertainty. You have to have flexible rules by GCD. We're managing under uncertainty. You got to have models that be updated all the time, and that's one of the keys we'll have to look forward to in the state.
James?
Sure. Models are tools. Being a modeler by trade and, you know, through my career, I really like that it taught me as much as it did. I'm not a fan of how the models have been integrated into the regulatory sort of framework, just simply because of the uncertainty involved in them. I think that sometimes they create more problems than they solve. I'm most interested, and I think probably most people will agree with this after you've studied it for a while, that the interactions or the changes that might happen in the shallow water table areas as we pump these deep confined artesian aquifers are really going to be that's really the point of these models, to figure out what it is that we're doing. One, are we depleting storage? Two, are we interacting? Are we affecting the environment? And the only way that these aquifers can interact with the environment is through these shallow water table areas, be it where a stream, a spring comes out, or maybe there's some trees that require a high water level. And so as much as we can do to improve the simulation of how those shallow water levels will change through time, I think that's a very worthy thing. At the same time, I think we need to always, again, just stay focused on what is the point of this model. Groundwater models were not, they're not the be-all. It's not a panacea. They were meant to give us a general idea of what regional pumpage would do on a regional sense. What is the regional response of the aquifer? And I think, for the most part, the models do a pretty good job as is. We can always improve it. Let's say we gain a 10% improvement in the accuracy of our drawdown calculations. That's worthy. That's something to strive for. And every time we update the model, we'll probably end up updating it or increasing the accuracy just a little bit more. We're going to take smaller and smaller steps. What it won't really tell us is whether or not what we're seeing as a model result is good or bad. That's something that we need to, we need to study specific stream reaches. Is the base flow to those rivers very important? Is it significant to the river flow in the first place? And were it to change over time, is that something that is worth us changing the way we manage the aquifer in order to change, to keep that the way we want it to? So I'm a fan of models. I think they teach us a lot. I'm a fan of models that have a purpose. In the end, will they tell us what we really need to know about whether or not these impacts are too much? I just don't think they will.
George.
I think we've all probably heard the old saying, all models are wrong and some are useful. And I think the GAM is an example of a useful model. Certainly it needs to be improved. I agree with particular what Steve said about looking at the effects of faults and looking at groundwater, surface water interaction. But I think that at this point, if you want the best estimate you can come up with of how pumping is going to affect the Carrizo-Wilcox aquifer, the model, the GAM, is going to give you that best estimate.
Very good. Well, we're going to go ahead and enter the questions from the public phase. I want to stress that we've got a lot of folks here, and I don't know how many questions we have, but if you can keep your questions short and very specific, Now's not the time to pontificate. We really want some questions for this esteemed panel of experts we have up here. So microphone is there in the back. And I see a first questioner approaching. No, he's going to the bathroom. Nope, he has a question. Good.
Hi. So this is just for the general, the whole panel, not for anyone in particular. So I guess it's not multiple questions, I just have to phrase it this way. So how have communities been involved? Have you done surveys in order to, have surveys been done in order to assess public feedback? And if so, what are those public feedback, what are their concerns? And if not, do you feel like a survey should be done in order to capture that information?
Well, I don't know of any surveys that have been done, but talking to folks who live in the area where a lot of the water is going to come from to serve the urban areas, no, they're concerned, and I think they're rightly concerned about how this great increase in pumping is going to affect the wells that they depend upon.
It also the property value that is. Some folks realize that in Texas, having water on the land is very important, and if they don't have a well, but the water is beneath them is lowering, they feel that there is some economic tie to that, and that's an issue that comes up quite a bit. The meetings we have are open. The GCDs have open meetings. They typically get folks come out when a permit shows up. They don't have meetings otherwise, but then you do hear the concerns, and those, these are the two concerns: land price and property. It's pretty easy to understand why, and I don't think you need a survey to go out and tell it. There's the folks that are tend to be in agreement with what's going on do not tend to show up at meetings. You know, where there's a lot of land that's maybe 10-12% or so is being leased there up around a northern area. They don't come out in support of the permits. It's the people that come out with concerns. A lot of it is because the information doesn't get out properly. Sometimes we have model results that do show scary predictions, and it's hard to understand how those predictions affect your well. It's not communicated very well. The aquifers are very complex. Robert had mentioned it's really important to note that what's down deep doesn't get to the surface out in Gulf Coast. You know, they've been pumping for God knows how long, decades, and they got 600, well, they used to have 500, 400 foot drawdowns, now there's less. But they've monitored these things at the surface, and the surface has just changed a few feet. It doesn't go vertically upward. It's not like a sphere. It's not like a ball that goes upwards. It follows these aquifers, and as we talked earlier, as it gets to the outcrop, the impacts start to dissipate really quickly because the aquifer properties changes. There really is a concern when they hit these big drawdowns, 400, 500, 600 feet. That's happening in these aquifers where you have a water column that's 3,000 feet. 500 feet is a big number, you know, in 60 years, but when you can turn that well off and literally have that well recover 200 feet, within a year, that's how it's operating that deep system. We got 300, maybe may have 2,000 feet of drawdown to work with, 500 feet, someone's paying for that money to raise the water, to pump it, but when it's all said and done, they turn it off, it's going to recover a couple hundred feet in a year or two. But it's not going to hit those shallow wells. It will not. And there's monitoring the Gulf Coast and a little bit in the Carrizo has shown that. And that is not communicated very well in our meetings.
Y'all guys have anything to add?
I mean, just about stakeholder input. You know, the groundwater management areas are regional groups of groundwater districts, and they're currently in the middle of planning what's known or basically developing what's known as a desired future condition of the aquifers. And these meetings are public, and there's been an awful lot of public comment and a lot of public involvement. So I think actually, you know, the whole process has actually been very open and straightforward.
Building on what James said, you know, generally groundwater districts will have public hearings related to permits, so there's opportunities for public input there. The desired future condition process is also very public. It's also sometimes perhaps, I don't want to say hidden, but I'll say it, you know, maybe a little hidden. Nobody really understands maybe what's going on, and so you don't quite get the involvement because the implications of those decisions arise later, particularly with permits. Who's next? Who wants to ask a question next?
With a lot of emphasis being on preventing harmful impacts to the aquifer and the environment, do you think that we need to update and modernize our management and modeling regimes so that we can account for the huge pumping sizes that we have nowadays and the possibility that a person given an annual permit could pump 90% of it in a few days if they brought to bear some of the pumps that exist now? And I know y'all talked about how the spatial distribution of pumping matters as far as whether harm is going to incur. But what about the temporal distribution, the timing, the rates of pumping and the timing of pumping? And certain pumpings, like with fracking, the pumping that may not be brought up to the surface may be put into some oil or gas play and never even, you know, taken into consideration at all. But surely those really extreme pumping events, you know, have a big impact and cause harm.
Thank you. Anybody want to take a stab at answering that question?
Well, I believe the issue of management of pumping was brought up, and just perhaps repeating a comment I made earlier, but I think it's very important that we take a go slow approach, a stepwise approach, so that as these, before we start increasing pumping by 100,000 acre feet a year, we need to do it slowly so we can see what the effects are increment by increment, so that we don't give somebody a right to pump 50,000 acre feet a year, find out it's a problem, and then try to pull that right back. I think that would be very difficult. So I think that we need to cautiously approach pumpage from the Carrizo Wilcox.
I'll add a little bit to the concern about the temporal aspect about it. There is a very high, in some counties, because of irrigation, and there's a very important temporal aspect to look at these processes. You know, working on the Gulf Coast, and, you know, this is an area in a county this summer that went dry when all the irrigation went on, and quite a few shallow wells went below. They were drilled too shallow. They only drilled about 100 feet, 20 or 30 of them went dry. It probably goes off to come back up. And, you know, we start looking for planning. You know, folks in the DFC process, sometimes we look at the winter water levels, and sometimes only GCDs only monitor the winter water levels. That's when the irrigation's off and waters recover. And that's something we should be aware of. All of you should be aware of that. The time you're going to get an impact is really when the summertime, if your highest pumping is going to occur. And, you know, when you work with your districts, you know, be aware that temporal aspect's important. And it's not the models that's going to drive this; it's the monitoring program. So when you get involved with your local managing agencies, your GCDs or Water Development Board, TCQ, you know, find out where that monitoring network is, and you know, they're always looking for wells, and it's hard to find a good monitoring network. It's expensive, but that's what's going to drive and give good management, is making sure that you have these monitoring wells, and that will eventually, you know, feed back into the model. So you're going to capture that if you get the monitoring, a seasonal monitoring system in. So I will say that's just an important part of management.
Sure. I mean, I can't stress this enough. What happens in the outcrops of these aquifers is really the important part when trying to determine what your environmental impacts would be. I'm a big proponent of, you know, using permit fee money to enhance the monitoring systems that these groundwater districts are now putting into place. Water table water level measurement monitoring wells all over the outcrop. That's my answer for this, is let's make sure that we know exactly how our shallow water table is behaving through time. Again, the physics of the aquifer won't allow it to change much through time, so we'll be able to spot these negative trends, these unacceptable trends, at a pretty early date and be able to ramp back pumpage, redistribute it, whatever we need to do if, as a society, we decide that the depletion rate or the impacts to our environment are unacceptable.
Next question.
Thank you. There was a lot of conversation tonight about evaluating impacts from the artesian zone on the outcrop or recharge zone of the aquifer. And I heard you say, Steve Young, early in the evening, those artesian zones are so deep that it's not cost-effective to pump from that depth compared to other alternatives. And that seems to me to be a little bit of an inconsistency. I wonder if I heard that right or if somebody would care to elaborate on that.
It would be financially infeasible to dewater the down-dip portion, not to pump. Dewater meaning bring the water table down below the top of the aquifer, which is thousands of feet down.
Sorry if I didn't make that clear.
Thank you. We've heard a great deal about the models and how they're used and how sometimes they're not used for the purposes that they were designed to be used for, and that there's a great deal of uncertainty that's related to those models. Yet we find ourselves in a condition where we have a societal situation where there's a rush, basically, to get the permits and to get the pumping done and to get on with the process of delivering the water, when we really, because we don't have the good models, we don't have the understanding that we need to be moving forward that fast. Along with that, we see that the models indicate and predict, the GAMs indicate and predict things that are contrary to what we've heard tonight. For example, I've looked at the GMA-12 GAM, and it predicts that the pumping that we're talking about will come mostly from decline of water to the outflows to surface waters and from other aquifers, and very little from storage. These things need to be rectified. What that kind of brings us to is where we've got a rush to move forward, and the models are not doing a good job of giving us some of the data that we need under some of the specific areas, particularly like groundwater-surface water interaction. Yet it doesn't look like we've gone through the policy decisions that need to be gone through to inform how we're going to further use these models. And what I bring up here then is the conservation amendment that basically says that we're supposed to conserve our natural resources first and develop our natural resources to the point that we can have a sustainable aquifer and still develop it. How are we going to get to that point of understanding what conservation means and how conservation can be used and modeled if we rush into the permitting process? So my question really is, what's the process? How do we move forward in doing the public policy decisions that need to be made as to whether or not streams and springs are important to everybody in the state, or whether or not they can be allowed to be damaged?
So you're asking a policy question, a scientist, but we'll roll with it.
I think anybody so. Wanna?
There we go. Okay, let's break this down. We're talking about three basic things here. The DFC process, desired future condition process, that's long-term regional planning. Now, in long-term regional planning, use of regional models to kind of look 50, 60, 70 years in the future is appropriate. Models should drive monitoring programs, not make decisions and be the end-all, be-all. The next level is management. Groundwater districts each have a management plan where they're required to, you know, deal with these specific goals that are listed out in statute and rule. The final step is regulation. That's where you get permits. So if you're using a groundwater model, a regional groundwater model, to look at big regional things among, in GMAs among lots of districts, that's quite different than using a big regional model to make a permit decision. Making a permit decision with one of these big regional models without any other supporting information is foolish. But you can use the models to help design monitoring programs where you have the acknowledgement of the uncertainty, where you know what the limitations are. You're backing up the models with common sense and with data to design monitoring programs, and what we've heard about before, these like these ramped pumping programs where we acknowledge that we don't fully understand everything. And frankly, in a system that really hasn't been stressed that hard, you're not going to know until you actually do it. So keep some perspective on the difference between a planning function and a permitting function, which are totally separate in terms of how you use the model results.
George? You're right. There is a lot of uncertainty involved here, and I don't think anybody can say for certain what's going to happen 20, 30 years out. Well, all we can do is give our best estimates based on available tools and data. But that points, I think, to the need to be cautious and go slow and not give out a bunch of permits, which urban areas will come to rely on the water from those permits, and then 10, 20 years down the road say, oh, we made a big mistake. Now, urban areas, please stop using that water that you've come to rely on. I think that would be very difficult to do, so we need to go slowly.
I'll jump in the deep end. I'm over my head on this one. I'll give it a swim. I think part of it is the fact how the legislation and laws are set up in Texas and versus some other states. Some other states can tackle that problem pretty easy because all the water belongs to the state, surface and groundwater. There's one entity, the state, that's creating the rules, and it may be out of one department too. So they can go through and create a cohesive set of rules and get agreement because they can have a strong board and get that done. In Texas, it's a little different, and Robert probably is better want to talk about that, but the laws are very different between surface is the state, groundwater is private property. Even that's not been fully understood. I'm baffled by every ruling exactly what it means. We could talk about that. There's lawyers in here that would love to take that on. And as also you have many different GCDs that are setting their own kind of guidelines and rules without any kind of legislative bar of what these rules really have to be. There's Chapter 36, but there's a lot of freedom in that. And then you have TCQ and the GCDs just being different entities. So it's really hard, I think, get them all on the same page to develop a comprehensive set of rules to tackle conservation. And I don't know. Someday, we all know this is going to come to head. It may be sooner than later. But I think that's part of the issue you're looking at. It's my two cents.
James? I'd just like to say that, if we want to know how the aquifers are going to behave with pumpage in the future, we should just look to see how they've behaved in the past with the pumpage that's already gone on. We talked about the current use from the aquifers being in the hundreds of thousands of acre feet. That's quite a bit of pumpage, and we have decades of water level measurements to go along with that. So if you really want to know how the aquifers are going to, how fast are they going to deplete, we simply have to look at what we already know about them to know how they're going to behave in the future.
And I'm going to throw in here a little bit also in that you've heard some discussion about purpose of models, and models have uncertainty, But they are useful tools, and one of the things you have to pay attention to is what are they calibrated to? What was the purpose? The groundwater management area 12 model was not really calibrated towards a base flow to rivers, in my opinion. I also think that model does not do a good job of accurately reflecting recharge, the recharge system. And so because it doesn't have the total recharge, the model is going to get the water from somewhere, and it's showing it coming from the rivers. What the model was calibrated to was what we've seen happen in the past with water levels. And so it has that experience, and then we hope we can carry that experience going forward. Since that model was developed, we know that there's concerns now about, you know, what the impacts are to rivers and streams, and so hopefully future versions will refine the recharge numbers and hopefully come up with better numbers and predictions along those lines. We have time for one more question.
Thanks very much. We've focused a lot this evening on the limits and the uncertainty around the Carrizo and what it can provide from a purely extractive perspective, but I wondered if you guys could help us understand what we know and what we don't know about how it can perform to help us bank surface water, excess flows, floodwaters, either through ASR or through spreading basins, or other sorts of mechanisms that are used across the West. Is this sort of formation something that can be used for those purposes? What do we know about how it can and can't be used?
I need 30-second answers.
I'll take 30 seconds. The ASR is certainly coming. You got any regional plan, we'll see them in all the regional plans. It is a very highly localized phenomenon. When you do ASR, it's when you're injecting water in. You keep it there a long time, pull it out, but the area of influence is typically less than a mile around an area. It has a good, it serves a good function to give you those initial properties to actually to do those different, you refine the model in that area and you can do a quick run. It's actually probably pretty useful. It serves as an excellent first pass at that. All of us might have done it. I've certainly have done that already several times.
Anybody else want to take a stab at that? All right, well, before I turn it over back over to Dr. Loftus, please join me in thanking our panel. Did an awesome job.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you for being so attentive and for participating tonight. Thank you very much.
Made it through. Good to see you.
Hi. Hi. Good job.
Models, 50 miles, 10 miles, they all trying to work on one. 10 miles, well, I was just curious.